Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris. Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay. And tonight we're dealing with the Book of Fire, Part 2. And we're going to go directly into the announcements because we have quite a few segments to put here and a great deal of information. We're offering our 14th Amendment and the Commerce Game exposed here this evening. And the way you get that is just simply, as usual, contact me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's TARHAKA99@yahoo.com. Also, if you have a Facebook account, go ahead and send me your friend request. I'll grant that. And that'll give you access to my wall where all my shows land. And you can go there and click on and listen to the broadcast anytime you get ready. And if you're on Dig or Twitter or MySpace, we're always there too. So connect me with me there. We're on the Conscious African Mind. We're on DropSquad. And we are also on the Moorish American network as well. Let me give you numbers to the conference call that happens 7 days a week involving the Moorish American National Government. And you simply dial 760-569-7100. And the access code is 437966 pound. And that is on Wednesday night when the Grand Master is teaching, the Divine Minister, Dr. Pleasant L. Bay. And on Tuesday night, you will dial 218-862-1442. And the access code there is 101-5555. And that way you are able to get in on Tuesday evenings at all times at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And on Tuesday night, the ladies' phone conference is available. Also, those of you who have businesses and stuff, we're making available airtime here on the show. And you contact me at area code 904-303-9061. We've created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States, and you access that by the same number I just gave, area code 904-303-9061. So we're coming to you, first of all, directly from the Book of Fire. And for those of you who have this book, we'll be coming to you from page 134, and it's called Identifying the Illuminati. And to identify the modern Illuminati, it would help for the reader to picture a colony of bees. Now, envision the hive as a global and structured as a pyramid of people. The queen bee, the eye, is the aforementioned wealthy world rulers. Most people are familiar with such dynasties as the Yorks, Vanderbilts, Hunts, DuPonts, Kennedys, Carnegies, Rockefellers, and Rothschilds, etc. Virtually all of these empires acquired their fame and wealth by illegal and strong-arm means, using the commoners as prey. Needless to say, the majority of these European financial giants' entire estates rest upon African slavery, oppression, conquest, and genocide of people of color. There are 10 multi-billionaires that compile the secretive Illuminati. Now, this is very important for us to understand. The Rothschild dynasty, the Rockefeller dynasty, the Habsburg dynasty, and those are the keepers of the Holy Grail. King Juan Carlos of the Roman Catholic Order, Holy Mafia, white Freemasonry. The Bohemian dynasty, World Jewish Congress, Jewish mystical systems linked to the Illuminati. Lord Peter Carrington, Hambro's Bank, and Bilderberg's financial banker of the Vatican and the P2 Black Masonic Lodge operation. Harry Oppenheimer, diamond billionaire, owns 95% of the world's diamond mines and true ruler and controller of South Africa. Giovanni Anginelli, Fiat Motors. Rupert Murdoch, biker for Newt Gingrich. Henrik von Pier, chairman, Simons, Prince Philip, Prince Bernhard, and George Soros, according to Daniel 7:23-24, these 10 kings occupy 10 seats, yet have no kingdom. The 10 seats of the global ruling powers are the government of the following: the USA, Canada, France. These 6 seats are in Europe and often filibuster world events in Eurodollar, Australia, Great Britain, Spain, and South Africa. These are the true 10 kings prophesied in the book of Revelation, chapter 17 and 12 through 14. Now let's take a brief look at the drones. These are parasites which suck from the world body of human resources for the sole purpose of fraternizing the queen bee, the 10 kings. In other words, like most churches, any college fraternities are incubators for Freemasonry's secret societies. So are the entitled listed below suppliers to the Illuminati. Okay, before we get into that, I just want to add that what we're going to do now is we're going to go back to the beginning, and we're going to reveal here this evening an interview between an African shaman by the name of Kredu Mudawa, and he's being interviewed by a gentleman by the name of David Icke. And we're going to hear what he has to say. Each one of these segments that we'll be playing is approximately 9 minutes and 46 seconds long. So we're going to go directly into what the brother is about to reveal.
I had entered school as a child of 14 years. And when I became a Sangoma, I was a youth of 16 years. And what my aunt and my grandma, my grandfather, as well as my maternal grandmother taught me, shook me to the core of my soul. I found that the mission schools had been teaching me lies about my people all along. Missionaries had told us as children that the only light came to Africa with white people. That before the white men came, we black people had no idea about God. We had no belief in a life after death. And that our people were just a race of savages who used to lie around in the sun, womanize, fight, and drink beer every day. I was suddenly awakened to the fact that Africans had in fact been far greater intellectually than the missionaries were willing to give them credit for. That like the white men, we had astrology, astronomy, we had surgery. In fact, I found that Zulu surgeons in the early years of the 19th century and the 18th century and even beyond could perform operations which white surgeons were not capable of operating. And the more I learned about my people, the more I wanted to learn. And when my initiation under my aunt Maina and my grandfather Zigo had ended, I wanted to know more and more and more. And sometimes I had to pay a ghastly price in order to gain this knowledge. In one place, here in the northwestern Transvaal, my teachers found that I was really uncircumcised. And they told me bluntly that if I wanted to be a member of this secret society, I had to undergo circumcision. And I did, and it was screamingly painful, I assure you, because it was done with a clasp knife, which somebody must have blunted a little bit, just to make sure that I got the message.
Well, I had the same done, but I was asleep at the time, so we have that in common.
And say, in some places in Southern Africa, if you wanted to learn the secrets of a certain secret society, you had to do dreadful things which I cannot repeat here. And at one time, in Barotriland, in the west of what is today Zambia, my teacher said, look, how far are you willing to go in order to become one of us? I said, I am willing to go anywhere. He looked at me and he said, listen, educated man, we are tired of people like you. White men come amongst us to milk our minds and then to kill us. We want to be sure that we can trust. And wait, sir. I said, great one, I am willing to do anything. He said, are you? I said, yes. And then, they went into a graveyard, and from there, they removed the hand of a corpse, dead 2 days, and they brought it and they challenged me to cook it and eat it. I did so. And these were the people who first told me about a race of highly intelligent beings which they called the Chitauri, the talker, a race of creatures which look like reptiles, who have ruled the world for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Through this dreadful act, I was able to gain knowledge which was denied to even the highest Sangoma, because they would not go through the ritual I went through. This is how secret knowledge is protected in Africa. And at one time, let me tell you another thing. Again, in Barotseland, on the border between Angola and North Rhodesia, as it was called, I was brought into a hut. And in the hut, was a young woman. She was as black as ebony, and her hair was like a huge black cloud on her head. Her teeth had been sharpened in the Barotse fashion until they looked like those of a reptile. And Mutwa was very puzzled. What's this lady doing here? This, I'm supposed to spend several nights in this hut, so what is she? What is she doing here? Now, Credo Mutwa, being a frightened Zulu, afraid of women but not afraid of wild animals, decided to sleep with his back to the wall, giving the lady a nice clean bed. And on the following day, Credo Mutwa was fined 15 pounds by the local chief because I had refused a sacred gift. I had been supposed to do something very amazing to this lady to show that I was one of the people.
Bad luck.
Bad luck. But
why, Credo, have you chosen to reveal this knowledge now to a much, much wider audience?
Mr. David, please, Africa is dying. Africa, is being murdered. And we are sitting like bloody fools. And we don't realize what's been done to our people. Say, I have proof that can stand in any true court of law that the disease called AIDS is a man-made disease. And this disease is going to kill 3/4 of South Africa's black people within the next 10 years. Say, there are wars in Africa which make no sense to me as a black man. Please, when people fight a war, Mr. David, why do they fight? People fight in order to get rid of something that is giving them pain. Whether that something is a tribal chief or a corrupt modern government, they want to fight to remove this burden or to be destroyed by it. That is the idea behind a rebellion. But in Africa, we find wars where a group of rebels challenges a government and tries to fight against it. And then these wars end in the total destruction of that particular country, where neither the rebels nor the government wins anymore. And why? Because you find this force of rebels facing the government, and all of a sudden the rebel army splits into little factions which start fighting each other and not the real enemy. And soon it becomes a situation where everybody is fighting everybody else and the whole thing is getting nowhere. I say that these wars which are destroying Africa this way are orchestrated by forces from outside Africa. Our people, need development. Our people need peace in Africa. We are basically a peaceful people. We are not warlike. Don't let historians tell you a lot of rubbish. Africa is not perceived by the people outside her as she really is. One, my people are Zulus, as a tribe famous for warrior exploits. for many, many years now. But wait, do you know, sir, that Zulu people actually hated war and didn't love it, as historians would have you believe? We Zulu people call war impi, I-M-P-I, and we call evil impi or ubumbi. Now, the word impi and the word impi come from exactly the same root, which means that which is evil. We call copper itusi, which means the helper, the frightener away of evil spirits. But we call iron insindi, which means the evil metal, the metal of war. Now, when a Zulu went to battle, he spiritually prepared himself for fighting. But when he came back from battle, a Zulu would undergo a ceremony of purification, a very, very painful ritual, which lasted for some 7 days before he was even allowed to touch his wife. But wait for this. In England, we have got the Lady Sarah Churchill, Duchess of Marlborough, writing in her diary that her husband, Sir John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, after the terrible Battle of Blenheim, had made love to her 3 times while still wearing his top boots. Wait, sir. Listen to that. Here is a man coming into his tent or whatever it was, with his boots still stinking with the blood of horses and the blood of men, and probably with human flesh still attached to the soles of those boots. Here is this man making love to his wife. What kind of attitude is that? That a man would come smelling of death and destruction to desecrate his wife in 3 torrid sex sessions? We never did that in Africa. We hated war. And furthermore, our people, the black people of Southern Africa, are accused of having been a male-dominated society. Absolute bloody poppycocks. Zulus were a female-dominated society. And if you want proof of that, ask yourself, who killed King Shaka? Who planned Shaka's murder? 2 women, twins, Mama and Mkabayi, Shaka's aunt. Who was the greatest advisor of King Shaka? His mother, Nandi, she used to plan every one of Shaka's military campaigns, right down to the last detail. So, everywhere in South Africa, our word for great also means female, but that is something we shall discuss at another time. So, Africa is being murdered. And a race of people which once founded some of the world's greatest civilizations is being cruelly exterminated, and our politicians appear to be hypnotized as like a little antelope hypnotized by a python. Don't our leaders know what is going on in Africa? I'm going to talk, sir. I'm going to talk, and I'm going to reveal and damn the consequences. I am not a brave man, but it's high time somebody stood up and exposed the conspiracy around Africa and her people.
So let's start looking then at the force that is the common theme through all this history to the present day that's been manipulating these highly malevolent, highly destructive situations. My own researchers around the world have certainly focused in on the fact that there is a force, not of this world, shall we say, that is the common theme. What is your experience and your knowledge of an extraterrestrial involvement in the history of Africa?
One of the most secret stories that was revealed to me is about these beings. This story was revealed to me first in Barotsident, then in the country today called Rwanda, once known as Rwanda Urundi. Then I learned about this story at that time on the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. This is the story, a story you find throughout Africa. There was once a time when the blue sky was invisible, when the whole world was covered with mist, when you could not see the sun as it is now, you only saw it as a splash of white light moving slowly across the sky. At that time, there was an eternal drizzle every day of the year. At that time, people could not see the stars. People only saw the trees growing, trees which were very, very big. There was no desert at that time, only jungle everywhere where you went.
Okay, that was the first two segments, and what we're going to do is we're going to come back to this African shaman. His name is Kwetu Mutua, and attempts was made on his life all the way up to the day that he made these audio, these video clips, and you can get the whole story and all subsequent clips on this by going to YouTube and typing in David Icke interviews Kwetu Mutua. Also, the same thing is for those of you who have Tahaka's archives, it is listed there. All of the video clips, the first segment, second segment, and the third segment is there in a row, so you can get the entire story. But I'm going to go here now and get the men and women who are living in the day that these bloodlines can be traced to. Okay, we're going to go to the second part right here on page 34 of the Book of Fire. And we've already read off the countries and the families. Now we're going down here to the bottom of the page. It says any members of these entities are drone servers to the Illuminati by oath, heritage, or entrapment. We have the following: the Federal Reserve System, General Agreement on Tariffs and Taxes, World Trade Organization, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Masonic Orders and Auxiliaries, Bilderbergers, Skull and Bone Society, Knights of Malta, the Club of Rome, Aspen Institute, Opus Dei, World Federalists, Bohemian Grove, World Economic Forum, Xerox, Mobil Oil, AT&T, General Electric, Atlantic, Richfield Oil, IBM, Prudential Insurance, Pepsi-Cola Company, Shell, Fiat, CBS, Chrysler, Bentley, Mellon Bank, CNN, Boeing, and FCC, et cetera, et cetera. All of the above are known as key global operatives, and their loyalty to ultimate European domination is well documented and stands without question. But none of these organized tentacles could function without human input. These are the mass level of the worker bees and are officially known as servers. Now, what we are doing is looking at a graphic depiction and a complete lineup of the actual people in operation and the systems that's in operation, tracing back to the bloodline that this gentleman is going to be revealing to us. So we're going to go directly into the next segment and hear what he has to say.
A human being was both male and female in one body. And out of the sky, one day, came terrible objects. They were like gigantic bones made of huge gleaming gold. They were shaped like bows without strings, and they were bigger than the biggest mountains. They came out of the sky, bringing great noise, black smoke, and fire with them. And out of those huge objects came them. At that time, sir, human beings could not speak. We had no gift of language at that time. And people had, however, great mental power. A man would go into the bush and, using the power of his mind, actually call out an animal which he wanted to hunt and kill for his children. And the animal would appear and kneel down before the man, and the man would kill the animal and take it home. But when the Chitauri arrived in Africa, they told our people that they were gods and that they were going to give us human beings great gifts on one condition. We had to worship them and accept them as our creator. Some told our people that they were our elder brothers and that this earth had produced them generations ago. And they said they had come back to the green womb of their mother, and that they were going to make us into gods. What they did, they created a very strange pair of caves in the land. They dug two caves. In one cave was a green light, in another cave was a red light. And they drove human beings into these caves. And each human being had to choose which cave the human being wanted to go into. And those who went into the green cave came out as women. And those who went into the red cave came out as men. And then the talkers, the Chitauri, told our people that now they were perfect. But the moment the first men saw the first women, a terrible row erupted. The women hated the men because they looked between their legs and they saw what they thought were snakes dangling between the legs of the men. And the men hated the women because they looked on their chests and they saw these big things. What they were, they did not know. And then the Chitauri laughed. It was to them a very, very big joke. And then the Chitauri said, if you serve us, you wretched little human beings, we are going to make you into gods. And the human beings agreed to serve the Chitauri. And the Chitauri gave human beings a second gift, the gift of language. People started talking with their tongues where they had talked with their minds before. And there was a big rubbish starting again, because this man did not know the language of that man, and when this man greeted that man thought that he was being insulted, and so a lot of murder and culpable homicide started taking place all over the world. When our people were given language, they found to their horror that they had lost much of their mental power. They had paid a terrible price. But the Chitauri were now the masters of human beings. They made them the human beings to go into holes in the ground and to mine metal, gold, copper, tin, all kinds of metal the Chitauri forced our people to mine. And the people were very unhappy because they couldn't cope with the new sexual differences which were there now between men and women. And then from amongst the Chitauri came a very good female Chitauri. Her name was Mai Nzarantwari Samahongo. Mai Nzarantwari Samahongo was the senior wife of the terrible chief of the Chitauri, Umbaba Gorontwari Samahongo. She was sorry for human beings, this great reptile lady. She said to the poor people, "Ow, you are unhappy." And the people said, "Yes, great one. We go into the holes every day, we dig the stones and we bring it to the gods, but we are not happy." And Mai Nzarantwari scratched her scaly chin and began to think and to think. She was terribly ugly. Her eyes were awful, like lights in the darkness. But she had mercy in her heart. And she taught the men and the women how to make love. And she said, "Look, we divided you into males and females. Now this action is going to bring you together." Ah, but it did not, because anyone who receives the gift from the Ntwari, the children of the python, is always in trouble. What happened was that when one guy slept with his wife, he didn't find her much, so he went to steal another guy's wife, and there was a big remorse, as we say in Afrikaans, starting. So men started stealing each other's wives and each other's girlfriends, and women started stealing each other's husbands, and there was a big nonsense in the land. And King Umbaba, the terrible lord of the Ntwari, the reptile people, said, "Look what you done, you stupid old woman. Now these people, they are making such a noise. Listen to all that screaming in the bush. They are busy making love there, and our gold is not being dug, and you are responsible for this." Nzarantwari thought and thought and thought and thought, and then she got a plan, and she said, "I will make them stop. When they make love to each other, the female is going to get pregnant. And when she is pregnant, the male is going to leave her alone, and that noise in the bush will not be so disturbing to you, my lord." And Umbaba said, "You had better. There is no production here." And so all the women in the world was pregnant, and Umbaba was furious with his wife. And so it went on and on, until one day Nzarantwari activated a black hero called Mweru. And Mweru challenged the great chief of the serpent people to a fight, and he cut off the royal penis of the king of the snake people, and that caused a big war. Mueru ran away, but Umbaba, the terrible chief of the people, caught him and arrested him and brought him to his village. And there, the great chief Korontwari Umbaba said, "Look, you cut off my thing, and I have replaced it with one made of gold, and I can't make love to my wife anymore. You think too much, you wretched little human being." Now, Umbaba had a terrible nail in one of his hands, a claw. And with this claw, he drove the claw into poor Mueru's nostril, making a terrible hole into his brain, and he started drinking Mueru's brain, and then he threw away the corpse. To this day, we believe that the people, the Chitauri people, they eat human brains. And strangely enough, scientists have found skulls where the human brain has been removed and eaten by someone or something.
Well, the hearing you speak here, so many things come to mind. First of all, you're saying that telepathy was the key form of communication for the Chitauri, the reptilians, kind of.
Yes, sir.
And I guess it's like a muscle. When you use it, it gets more sensitive and more powerful, so the more you use your telepathy, the more powerful your mind got. And then when language came, it almost brought us into this three-dimensional world and disconnected us from that mind power.
Yes.
And it's also interesting that the story that you talk about, the language being given, and then the different languages being given, of course that turns up in the Old Testament, in the Bible. It turns up in stories all over the world about the fact that we were divided by language so we couldn't communicate. And as someone who publishes books, I know today how difficult it is to communicate through books when you've got endless different languages. So
yes.
It's been a brilliant form of control for a long time.
Yes, sir. Even now here in South Africa, today, sir, black people prefer to speak to each other in English if they belong to different tribes. And they have even, over the many decades, black youths have even created a lingua franca of their own, which we call Tsotsi language, which is a mixture of African words and Afrikaans words. They do this in order to bridge the incredible language gap which exists between black people in South Africa. Let me show you an amusing thing, how different languages are. The language of the Xhosa people of the Eastern Cape is very similar to Zulu, but certain important words in the Zulu language, good words, are viewed as obscenities by the Xhosa people. For example, in the language of the Zulus, an ancestral spirit is called idlozi. But if you use that word to a Xhosa, he says you are using a dirty word, because to them, idlozi means sexual desire. And in the language of the Zulus, maize meal, is known as impupu. But in the language of the Bapedis, maize meal is called bupi. And if a Zulu uses the word impupu in front of a Bapedi woman, she feels that he has insulted her, because in the Bapedi language, impupu means a woman's sexual organ. And in the language of the Mashonas, in the language of the Zulus, a mother is called Mama. If I say my mother, I say Mama Wami. But in the language of the Mashona, the people of Eastern Zimbabwe, the word Mama means to sit down and have a crack. So one day when I said to my Mashona host, Ngikhumbule umama, which in Zulu is, I remember my mother, I'm missing my mother, the Mashona gentleman immediately took me and directed me to his pit latrine at the back of his house. Because in the Mashona way, mother is my, not mom. So you see this terrible difficulty, this subtle problem of language is a very big obstacle to communication in Africa. So we designed languages. There's another language called Fanagalo, which is a lingua franca consisting of African words as well as nonsense words and Zulu words, which was used a lot in the mines in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. So to bridge this great language gap, we have created artificial languages in Africa. But today, English is the preferred language of communication. Some say we should learn French, also another language of communication in Africa.
Some of, you know, the problems of language can be funny, but it is the same situation, the divide and rule, that is actually, in other expressions, created this tremendous turmoil in Africa and other places in the world. And we're looking, from my research and staggeringly hearing you talk, you're saying exactly the same as I've come across. It's incredible confirmation that a reptilian race from another world has been behind the manipulation of humanity for a very, very long time. Now, what do these Chitahuli actually look like, the reptiles?
I'm not a good artist.
You're better than me, that's for sure.
But this is how we believe the Chitahuli look like. They were created in this. You see, sir, you white people say that there are alien beings on this earth. No, you are wrong. The earth in which we live has produced 24 different races during its long existence. Please, this is how a Chitahuli looks like. It stands about 11 feet high. It is a very slender being, which seems not to have a bone structure. Its fingers have no joints. They are more as if the bones in here were flexible. Some of the Chitahuli have got three claws with a thumb. Some have got six claws with a thumb. And some of the Chitahuli have got horns on their heads. And what surprises me is this. Some film producers, like the producers who make the film Star Wars, often show creatures in their films which actually exist, which even the most uneducated of Africans who knows this Chitahuli can identify. For example, in the new Star Wars film, what is it called? Star Wars.
Okay. Let us go back directly into the Book of Five, but before we continue with Kratos' story, which is quite incredible. But before I do that, I just want to add that there are books out, I don't have access to them, of the archaeological finds and cave drawings around the world that depict these same creatures that he's describing, and also the skulls that have been found with the hole inside the skull and the brain has been missing. And I wanted to add that in. Also, we have to keep in mind that we are dealing with the bloodlines, and what we're trying to do is get the basic foundation of the what is called the Illuminati and the rulers of this world and how they came to be and why is it that the world is in so much of chaos. And but we want to also add the defense mechanism that has always been put in, that's already been put in place. And this defense mechanism is at the very, very foundation of the constitution of the Moorish American national government. And it is outlined as a love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice. Now, love is a very, very powerful force, and as we go along in the broadcast, he's going to describe how these creatures exist, and it is the opposite of all five of these principles. But when we, as living, breathing beings, come together and realizing the power that we have a defense. Now, I'm going to go in and I'll take up where I left off at page 135, and we just mentioned earlier about the worker bees. Servers, and now we're going to go on forward a little more. Servers are the individual puppets with authoritative strings attached to the drones, which are our suppliers. As worker bees, they do not have the continuity to become queen bee. Like so, servers are never the Illuminati itself. They are the high-profile figures which the public or private sector see as their bosses, leaders, and covert exigencies. In the Illuminati pyramid, all the Earth's common people are more servants, only visibly recognized by their work titles. Presidents, corporate chairmen, CEOs, prime ministers, popes, rabbis, deans, diplomats, generals, church pastors, judges, all political stations, directors in most managerial positions, etc. Because they are structured, produced, and chosen, these leaders under colorable authority rarely realize they are only the tops of the masses at the bottom of the pyramid. Ironically, most servers are ignorant of how they became strong as puppets, especially when all they did was try to be a good patriot, get a college miseducation, and pursue a career climbing to the political, religious, or corporate ladder. Yet this process is exactly how they become servers to the Illuminati. While the majority of these professional constituents will deny it is their own foot upon their own neck, they need only check to see if they took any oaths along the administrative ladder of the status quo that enabled them to help me God. Through oath-taking ceremonies, especially in the public graduation ceremonies, oath-taking degrees in fraternities, sororities, and secret societies. All of these are allurements baited with Illuminati hooks hidden well within the MHK as 39 and 7, as explained previously in Freemasonry. The only purpose of ceremonial oath is to make the committed man or woman accept gods of men as being superior to the great God of truth. This is why Noble Drew Ali clearly said, if you are honest, oaths are unnecessary. MHK 4323. The version of So Help Me God oaths of today are educational, religious, and political nets of the Illuminati cast out into the sea of humanity. Now, I just want to add that in, and we're going to go on into the next segment and let the brother finish telling his story.
Something like that. There is a creature who amazes me called the Darth Maul. Darth Maul is a red and black being with a ring of small horns right round his head. That is exactly what the cheetah woolly look like. Some have got ordinary heads without any horns on their heads. These are the lesser cheetah wool. But the royal cheetah wool have got a ring of sharp horns all around their heads. And the very high cheetah wool, like their king, Mubaba Famahongo, they have got very long horns which grow this way. Not that way like a bull, but this way like certain antelopes. Now, I just wonder, where these feeding producers get their information from. And in one strange feeding, which my student called me to come and watch, there is the thing called Stargate 2. Mm-hmm. And in that feeding, there was a creature, a very slimy, cream-colored creature with heavy wrinkles on its face. It was a spitting likeness of Mubaba Famahongo, the terrible emperor of the cheetah.
Well, clearly there's a tremendous amount of knowledge of what's been going on and what is going on, which comes out symbolically through films and areas of communication like Hollywood. But the thing that I'm totally stunned the more I talk to you about this is because I've been all over the world having people give me descriptions of seeing reptilian type figures, particularly people in positions of power in the world, changing into a reptilian figure and coming back again. And what they describe seeing is exactly what the knowledge of ancient Africa talks about seeing. We're talking about the same people there, which is an astonishing confirmation. And the eyes is something that keeps coming up being described. Tell me about the eyes of the Chitahuli.
Say, a warrior Chitahuli has got eyes like a snake. These eyes are yellowish with split pupils and they glow in darkness. So if a Chitahuli, a warrior Chitahuli, one of the lesser classes, is hiding in a cave, you can see its eyes burning. But a royal Chitahuli has got three eyes. It's got the yellow eyes, which glow in a strange, almost ice-like way, like jewels, like certain types of yellow jewel. And then they have got an eye in the center of their forehead, an eye which doesn't close up down like a normal eye does, but which closes from side to side and which opens this way. Now, this eye of the cheetah is the eye that kills, because it can knock a man down just by the fire, the glare that comes out of it.
Is this where the constant recurring theme of the evil eye comes from?
Yes, sir. In fact, Mubaba, the emperor of the Chitauri, who is said to be still alive today, Mubaba has got a central eye. His other two eyes were stitched shut by a jealous wife. But his killing eye, the Famahongo, the terrible red eye, open. He can even open it like this. Mr. David, I would like to share a little thing with you. It is this. The best way to protect an evil thing is to deny its existence. And if you talk about things such as the Chitauri, if you talk about things such as the Mandinda, there are many people who say to you, rubbish, this thing does not exist. Now, in this way, this great evil is protected by being denied. One day in my long travels through the world, I was in New York, in that place called Harlem, and I saw a graffito on a wall along a passage, and the graffito was, there is no such a thing as the mafia, and we will kill any asshole who says that they. In this, again and again, in America, people deny the existence of the mafia, and by denying it, actually protect it, wittingly or unwittingly. There are those who deny that a national and international conspiracy exists. They deny it ferociously. But by denying it, they are actually assisting it and actually protecting it. We must stop denying the existence of these things. We must stop saying that there are no Chitauri, that there are no aliens, that there are no Illuminati. There are. I could tell you for hours. For example, do you know what we Zulu people call a person, a very, very clever person, a very, very wise person, a person who has received light from God? We call him Umkhanyiselwa, in other words, the illuminated one. Kanyisa means to light up something. And Umkhanyiselwa is somebody who has been lighted up by the God. So you say Illuminati, I say Umkhanyiselwa. It's the same thing.
And my research very clearly, and again, you're right, there's tremendous denial of this is a fact. Even among conspiracy researchers, there's tremendous denial that the Chitauri, the reptilians, and the Illuminati are actually the same thing.
Exactly the same. Because amongst my people, we say that when two Chitauri are challenging each other for power, and they must fight a duel with their terrible eyes, they start glowing.
Okay, that is the end of that segment. And I just want to stop for a minute and offer some other information. For those of you who are just tuning in, we are listening to the interview between the African shaman, Kredu Mutwa, who had many, many attempts on his life all the way up to the very day he attempted to reveal this type of information. They have even killed his child. He's been attacked and beaten severely because of the information that he's revealing to us by the powers that be. And also, I wanted to add that we are offering our free reports, the 14th Amendment, exposed and the commerce game as usual. And the way you get a hold of that is contact me and just send me a little quick notes and give me those articles you mentioned and I'll send it to you. Just contact me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com. And for those of you who are wanting to register with the Moorish American National Government, you simply go to Seven Seals Publications sevenseals.com. That's sevenseals.publications.com. Click on the registration link and enter your information and click send. You can also go to the moorishamericangov.org, moorishamericangov.org, and you can register there as well. And let's not forget the conference calls that happen every 7 days a week at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you dial into that 760-569-7100, and the access code there is 437966 pound. Ladies have their conference call on Tuesday night, and you dial 218-862-1442, and the access code is 101-55-55. Once again, that's 101-55-55 pound, and you can get on into the class that way. And make sure that anytime you go into the class, you have your paper and pencil handy so that you can take notes, and you use the props on your phone, your star 60 phone, to mute, star 60 phone back to if you have a question or comment. And that's happening 7 days a week at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You are registering in, and that way we have a record of who's participating in their own government. The brother will be going to the UN shortly and taking the final tally census so that they can be signed and be the Moorish American National Government will be declared a bona fide government at that time. Now we're going to go directly on into the our next segment and finish listening to what the brother is saying. Sorry about that. We had a little technical difficulty there. Let us go back here and try this again.
Something like that. There is a creature who amazes me called Darth Maul. Darth Maul is a red and black being with a ring of small horns right round his head. That is exactly what the cheetah woolly look like. Some have got ordinary heads without any horns on their heads. These are the lesser cheetah woolly. But the royal cheetah woolly have got a ring of sharp horns all around their heads. And the very high cheetah woolly, like their king, Mubaba, from like fishes deep in the sea. And the faster they glow, the angrier they are said to be. Now that is why there are certain parts of Africa where people are advised not to walk at night, because that is where the Chitauri often fight. And one of these parts of Africa, Seth, is a remarkable place called the Mountains of the Round Rocks, Matopo, wrongly pronounced Matopo, in Zimbabwe. These hills are really not remarkable in themselves. These hills are said to be the one place in Africa where the Chitauri have been seen. And these hills is where Cecil John Rhodes lies buried, but there is more. You must visit this place at one time. Amongst the rocks on the Matopo Mountains, you find a species of lizard which you don't find anywhere in Africa or the world. A species of lizard which responds to the call of a human being. When I first arrived in 1958 in the land called Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe, I found an African there who was a tourist attraction. He was a game warden who made strange sounds calling out, wah, 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 wah. And as he called out, these strange lizards, the only type of lizard anywhere on earth which responds to the human voice, used to come out of cracks and out of holes in the ground and to gather around these Africans. And it was this African game warden who told me that the sounds he is making are not just noise. They are the speech of the Chitauri Stago.
And it's a staggering coincidence that Cecil Rhodes, one of the greatest Illuminati frontmen, perhaps of certainly of modern times, who did so much to imprison Africa, should choose to be buried at the point where this is all going on.
You see, sir, Cecil John Rhodes wormed his way into the hearts of Africans, and in their despair, wise men of the Mashona people, wise men of Matebele people, tried to make Cecil John Rhodes one of them. They told him about the secrets of the Matopo Mountains, that under the Matopo Mountains lies a city of great wisdom, which is the home of the last survivors of the Chitauri god beings in that part of Africa. And if you go to the Matopo Mountains and you carry a 4-pound hammer and you strike certain parts of that landscape with that hammer, it gives out a hollow sound which shows you that there are caverns deep underground there. There are two sets of mountains. There is the Matopo Mountains, and then to the east of Zimbabwe, there are the great mountains known as the Inyangani, the Weeping Moon Mountains. There, even now, people disappear without trace. Sometimes a person would disappear for several days and reappear a few days later, not knowing where he had been or where she had been. And white people have disappeared there. Black people in their thousands have disappeared there. It was there that I also went missing for 4 days in 1959 in one of the most traumatic experiences of my life.
What happened?
Well, it's a long story, sir. My teacher, Elizabeth Moyo, had sent me to get a special herb which grows only on the foothills of those mountains. It was just an ordinary day like any other, just beautiful day like this one outside here. And I love the African wilderness. I'm at home in the bush, especially in the days when I was still in good health. I love the animals. I love their smell, and I love the smell of the vegetation. And I was looking for this herb when all of a sudden a bright blue mist fell all around me. It took me some time to react to the strange thing. It was a hot day, and all of a sudden the temperature around me dropped. It was as if I was on the slope of a very cold mountain, but it was a warm day. And then the next moment, I was in what appeared to be a metal-lined tunnel a curving panel, and I was lying on what looked like a workbench, a very large workbench of some kind, you know, an iron table which an engineer or somebody working with metal would use for welding and cutting metal upon. But this workbench was very brightly polished. And there I was lying there with my trousers missing and only my khaki shirt, when I saw again through what appeared to be like blue mist a number of moving objects which at first I thought were dolls. And these objects were moving towards me. I noticed with mild surprise that they were very thin, short, human-like creatures with very, very large melon-shaped heads. The creatures had no noses, like as human beings have. They had only small little holes on either side of where the nose would be, and their mouths were like knife cuts at the bottom of their faces. And these creatures were coming towards me. In color, they were gray like certain types of fish, and they wore silvery gray garments which reached up to their necks and up to their wrists. I couldn't see whether they were wearing boots or not at that time. And while I was looking at these creatures, I suddenly was aware that something was above me, standing there, and I looked up straight into the face of one of them, a much taller one than the others. And this creature was wearing a garment, like a tight-fitting overall, without any buttons or anything, which reached up to its neck, but its wrists were bare. I noticed that the creature had very long fingers. Its fingers had extra, and each of its fingers had an extra joint, and it ended in a claw, a black claw like that of a chicken or a certain kind of bird, and that its thumb was not here, but here in the middle of the hand. And this thing was standing above my head and looking down at me, and I was looking at its eyes, which were very strange indeed. It was as if it was...
Okay, now that ends segment number 7, and we're going to continue the story here this evening and with the remaining time. But we're going to go over here, and let's come up to the 20th century, because we're dealing with the bloodlines. Let's see what we got here.
Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, and a band of bonesmen robbed the grave of Geronimo, took the skull and some personal relics of the Apache chief and brought them back to the tomb. There is still a glass case, bonesmen tell me, within the tomb that displays a skull that they all refer to as Geronimo.
The preoccupation with bones, mortality, with coffins, lying in coffins, standing around coffins, all this sort of thing, I think, is designed to give them the sense that, and it's very true, life is short. You can spend it, if you have a privileged background, enjoying yourself, contributing nothing, or you can spend it making a contribution.
And plenty of bonesmen have made a contribution. From William Howard Taft, the 27th president, to Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine, to W. Averill Harriman, diplomat and confidant of U.S. presidents.
What's important about the undergraduate years of Skull and Bones, as opposed to fraternities, is that it imbues them with a kind of mission for moral leadership. And it's something that they may ignore for 30 years of their life, as George W. Bush seemed to successfully ignore it for quite a long time. But he came back to it.
A born-again bonesman, you might say. who, like his father and grandfather before him, has refused to talk openly about Skull and Bones. But as a Bonesman, he was required to reveal his innermost secrets to his fellow Bones initiates.
They're supposed to recount their entire sexual histories in sort of a dimly lit, cozy room. The other 14 members are sitting on plush couches, and the lights are dimmed, and there's a fire roaring. And this activity is supposed to last anywhere from between 1 to 3 hours.
So George Bush, George W. Bush, recounted his sexual history?
That would have been something they would have done, yes.
What is the point of this?
I believe the point of the year in the tomb is to forge such a strong bond between these 15 new members that after they graduate, for them to betray Skull and Bones would mean they'd have to betray their 14 closest friends.
One can't help but make certain comparisons with the Mafia, for example. Secret society, bonding. Stakes may be a little higher in one than the other, but everybody knows everything about everybody, which is a form of protection.
I think Skull and Bones has had slightly more success than the Mafia, in the sense that, you know, the leaders of the five families are all doing 100 years in jail, and the leaders of the Skull and Bone families are doing 4 and 8 years in the White House.
Bones is not restricted to Republicans. Yet another Bonesman has his eye on the Oval Office. Senator John Kerry, Democrat, Skull and Bones, 1966.
As we speak, we have the very real possibility of the next presidential election pitting one Bonesman, John Kerry, versus another Bonesman, President Bush.
It is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, again, all the people say, oh, these societies don't matter, or the Eastern establishment is in decline, and you could not find two more quintessential Eastern establishment privileged guys. I remember when I was a nerdy scholarship student in the reserve book room at the Yale Library, and John Kerry, who at that point styled himself John F. Kerry, would walk in.
As in JFK.
At JFK, yes. There was always a little buzz, because even then he was seen to be destined for higher things. He was the head of the Yale Political Union, and a tap for Skull and Bones was seen as the natural sequel to that.
David Brooks, a conservative commentator who's published a book on the social dynamics of the upwardly mobile, says that while Skull and Bones may be elite and secret, it's anything but exciting.
My view of secret societies is they're like the first-class cabin in airplanes. They're really impressive until you get into them. And then once you're there, they're a little dull. So you hear all these conspiracy theories about Skull and Bones.
Conspiracy to run the world.
Exactly. And to me, to be in one of those organizations, you have to have an incredibly high tolerance for tedium. Because you're sitting around talking. You're not running the world. You're just gassing.
Gassing or not, Skull and Bones, the best-connected white man's club in America, has moved reluctantly into the 21st century.
Skull and Bones narrowly endorsed admitting women. The day before these women were supposed to be initiated, a group of Bonesmen, including William F. Buckley, obtained a court order to block the initiation, claiming that letting women into the tomb would lead to date rape. Again, more legal wrangling. Finally, it came down to another vote, and women were admitted and initiated.
Skull and Bones now has women. It has Jews, it has blacks, it has gays, correct?
It has the gays who got the SAT scores, it's got the gays who got the straight A's, it's got the blacks who are the president of the right associations. It's different criteria, more multicultural, but it's still an elite, selective institution.
So on balance, you find as bizarre as Skull and Bones seems to be from a certain perspective, it is something of value, you would say?
You take these young strivers, you put them in this weird castle. They spill their guts with each other, fine, but they learn something beyond themselves. They learn a commitment to each other, they learn a commitment to the community, and maybe they inherit some of those old ideals of public service that are missing in a lot of other parts of the country.
Does that relationship, forged with all this mumbo-jumbo and coffins and skulls and bones and all of that stuff, does that become, in some cases anyway, stronger than family, faith?
Absolutely. You know, they say the motto at Yale is for God, for country, and for Yale. At Bones, I would think it's for Bones.
Okay. Let's get back to our brother Credo, and let's hear what else he has to say.
Plastic goggles over its eyes. I could see its eyes inside these tinted goggles, and it had holes on either side here, but it had no nose as I have. Its jaws were very small, and its mouth was a slit with tiny little scale-like things where its lips should be. And the creature carried a horrible smell on it. I can't describe that smell. It was a metallic, chemically smell, which seemed to combine the smell you would smell when somebody is burning brass or copper, and a very ugly chemical smell, these two smells combined. And this creature was looking down at me. I was frightened, but I could not move. And the next thing I knew was a terrible pain on my left thigh. It was as if somebody had just stabbed me right to the bone. I screamed and I tried to jump away, but my body was inactive. I could not move. I was not tied to any chain. I was not chained to the top of this table. There was no belt tying me, but I could not move my body. And when I looked down at what was happening, I found that one of the shorter creatures had driven something very painful into my left thigh. And then, while I watched, horrified, the creature pulled out his thing, and I saw that it was like a pencil made of shining metal with what appeared to be a flexible cable at the back. And before I could do anything, my head was seized by the creature above me. It caught me on either side of the head like this. And then a third creature drove something into my right nostril here. It was as if I had been shot. The pain was so terrible that I screamed and screamed. Blood filled my mouth. Blood spattered out of the nostril. And the creature did not seem to care. I was stupefied. The pain was so intense, so terrible. And then, quietly, brutally, the creature pulled out the thing that it had stabbed me in the nose with, and blood flowed into my mouth, into out of my nostrils, and I was choking. And then the big creature coldly turned my head this way so that blood came out of the mouth, and which gave me some kind of relief. And after what seemed like an eternity of pain, the creature brought something out of somewhere, which looked like an old-fashioned tea strainer in appearance, and it put this thing close to my nose. And then I seemed to drift away, and the pain subsided. You know, sir, it was torture so intense that even now I can't describe it. And then something else happened. A fourth creature started rummaging between my legs, and it pulled out my organ of manhood and stuck something into that. It was very strange. But I wasn't feeling any pain now. But I could feel the flexible cable moving inside me, right into my body. And then, I can't describe it. It was as if my seed was being sucked out by this small, bright, flexible cable. And then the creature just pulled it out. I screamed and I cried and I screamed, but I could not move. And then something happened, which to this day still amazes me. After the creature had pulled out the flexible cable from my organ, the creature just stood there looking at my organ. And I was so terrified that I urinated and accidentally urinated against the chest of the creature. It jumped away as if I had shot it, and it stumbled backwards. But its face didn't show any expression. Its mouth didn't even open, but the way the creature reacted, trembling all over, it was as if I had really hit it, but it was wearing this kind of garment. And after that, I was left alone, except for the big creature, which stood to my right side this time, with its arms folded, looking down at me. And then, while I was looking at this creature, trying to appeal to it, no pain anymore. No pain, please, I was pleading. Pictures suddenly flooded my mind. Pictures of buildings sunk in a red lake of water. Buildings rotting away. Buildings that appeared as if they had been bombed. And cities sunk in terrible mud. Trees sticking out like rotten ghosts, trees without leaves, without branches, sticking out of the mud as if they had been poisoned. I saw visions of this. And then, through an entrance which I had not seen before, came a strange and terrible being. It was exactly like this. It was tall, made entirely of metal, with burning eyes and a snout. It didn't do anything. It just moved and came to stand at my left side. It didn't touch me or anything like that. It just stood there, making a strange humming sound. Wow, 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 like that. And then, from behind this metal creature, there appeared another creature. It was so radically different from the gray creature in that it looked exactly like an earthly human being. It had a pink skin, like that of a white woman. It had golden hair, and its ears were definitely pointed, like those of an animal. Its eyes were slightly slanting. They were pale, pale blue, and never once did they blink. It was like this, nude, and there was a tail-like appendage at its back, which was very visible as it walked away after it had done to me what it did. What this thing did, it climbed over me and made love to me. And I noticed that, unlike normal women, its breath out of that room after the metal creature and this pink creature had gone. This creature took me out of that room, assisted by another one, and they pushed me along a corridor which curved slowly in that direction, towards my right. And there I was shown many things which even today I don't understand. I was shown little versions of this creature swimming in huge cylinders made out of what looked like glass, in a pinkish liquid, like ugly little frogs inside the liquid. They looked like aborted human fetuses. They were very, very terrible and disgusting. And then we came to another room, and there I saw a number of people undergoing the same torture that I had undergone. One particular person whom I passed very close to was a white man, definitely a European, with a yellowish beard and mustache and long, straggly blood-crusted hair. This man looked into my eyes and I looked into his eyes, and we were so close we were as I went past him. Then, to cut a long story short, I found myself in the bush again. But I was wearing only my shirt. My boots were gone, and so was my trousers. So I took off my shirt and wore it around my waist as a loincloth. And I started traveling, not knowing really in which direction I was going. Then I came to a track, and I walked along that. And some time later, I saw people coming towards me. It was a group of young men and young women, Mashona people, and they were going to a trading store, I later learned. I asked them where Elizabeth Moyo's homestead was, and they directed me to it. But they kept a safe distance away from me. And later I learned why. I was carrying a horrible, non-human smell upon me. When at long last I came to Mrs. Moyo's village, all the dogs in that place went hysterical. They came at me in a pack, wanting to tear me to pieces. And only the villagers managed to save my life there. Mrs. Moyo asked me where I had been, and I said I did not know. And then she said, "I know you had been taken by the little ones." I said, "Yes, I cannot understand." She said, "You must not try to understand. You were chosen by the gods as a living sacrifice. So don't even try to talk about this." But how could I not talk about it? I wanted to understand what had been done to me, by whom and why. Even now, I still want to understand what it was all about. And many years later, I met a remarkable white woman, Elizabeth Clara, a famous South African woman who had worked for British intelligence during the war, and who, we are told, had been impregnated by a being from the stars, Akko. I asked Elizabeth what was the meaning of the strange thing which was done to me, because since that time, I had come across many black people, well over 200, who had been through the same torture as I. I had come across many black as well as Cape colored women who had been mysteriously impregnated by the same creature that I had gone through the hands of. And let me tell you one other interesting thing before I forget. About a year after I had underwent this terrible experience, I was walking along Jeppe Street in Johannesburg delivering parcels when a white man shouted at me to stop. I stopped. I thought he was a policeman wanting to arrest me for some reason. And when I tried to produce my identity document, the white man said, "Listen, I don't want your nasty word, passbook kefa." I said, "Then, sir, what do you want, boss?" He said, "Listen, where did I see you? Where did I see you?" I said, "I don't know, boss. But he looked very familiar to me." And then he said, "Listen, don't bullshit me, man. Where did I see you? Where did you and I meet?" Then I said to him, "I saw you in Rhodesia, in a certain place. You were lying on a table. If I had hit that white man with a fist, he would not have reacted the way he did. He went pale, almost dirty gray in appearance, and he turned away with a terrible dirty word and he walked away. His eyes were filled not with anger, sir, but with pure naked terror."
Astonishing story.
Yes, but there is more, sir. There is more, because I still want to know what was done to me. Sir, one day you and I must talk more in greater depth than now. I would like to tell you that since that time, I have found that I know things that a man of my standard of education shouldn't know. These hands, and those who know me can confirm this. These hands not only have made these sculptures using ancient African metal casting secrets. These hands, believe it or not, can make guns and working jet engines. And one day I wish you to come back to South Africa and I will show you one of these. I know things which I shouldn't know, and it started at that time. Now, you see, sir, I want to know, what am I? Since that terrible time, my life as a man was really messed up. And one day I will, let me tell you, sir, since that time, I have become a very confused creature. It's embarrassing, really. But since that terrible day, I became bisexual, which to me as an African is a very, very disgusting. Since that time, my mind doesn't seem to be my own. I think about things that a man like me shouldn't bother himself about. I worry about people. It's sickening that I have ruined my life because of worrying about people. I feel that I want to shake, to take every human being on this earth by the shoulders, shake them roughly and say, listen, Pastor, there is more to this earth than you think. Say, I have seen the chitons. I have smelt them. I have had personal experience of these. And there are people who claim that these creatures are gods. There are people, sir, who claim that these creatures are experimenting on us. That is a lot of rubbish. These creatures are harvesting us. These creatures are not aliens, Mr. Ike. These creatures are sexually compatible with our women. And what does that tell you? It tells you that they came from here. They are part of us. And this makes them all the more dangerous. They know us very, very, very well. They know the great weaknesses of our minds, just as they know the great strengths of our minds. They operate in what I call the gray area of human existence, that side of our lives which we don't want to acknowledge the existence of. They create, African tradition says that the Chitauri, where they engaged God himself in a terrible war, and God defeated them, the real God, Nkulunkulu, the creator. God defeated them, and he closed their mouths so that they are unable to talk or to eat food anymore. But we are told, sir, that the Chitauri fatten on the energy that we human beings give them. They make us to fight each other. And when the whole land is drowning in death and fear and terror, when hundreds and hundreds of people are angry and afraid, the Chitauri get fat because they eat that what we call the dark power, which is brought about when human beings destroy the planet on which they live.
They feed on human emotion.
Yes, sir. Very, very intense human emotion. We are told, for example, that if you see a Chitauri walking through the bush or just standing there and looking at you, and you are accompanied by your wife or your girlfriend, you must immediately make love to that girlfriend and release as much emotion as possible, and the Chitauri will be pleased and will walk away from you and not harm you. And another thing, sir, we are told that the Chitauri eat energy which is generated when hundreds of human minds or one human mind starts thinking at certain levels. We are told that the Chitauri want us to think at certain levels.
Certain wavelengths.
Yes, sir. And they reward us with long life. May I ask you, sir, have you ever thought, as a thinking person, why is it that in the great universities of this world you find professors who think at certain levels and who live unnaturally long lives. Albert Einstein, Raymond Dart, Robert Broom, all these professors live a long, long time. And my aunt mine, the last Sanusi in South Africa other than myself, is as active as a young girl, and yet she's close to her 99th year of life. My stepmother, Rose, she has lost nearly all her children, and she is still alive. Extreme longevity is the reward with which the Chitauri reward you if you think at certain wavelengths.
The description of your abduction clearly is describing what has become known as the Greys, what I think is also known by some as the ant people, the grey figures with the big black eyes. How do you think they connect in with the openly reptilian? And do you think that the black covers of the eyes are covering some kind of reptilian truth?
See, the so-called grey aliens are actually the lackeys and the servants of the Chitauri. If you see a Chitauri and you see this, there is very little racial difference. In fact, I will even go so far as to say this, that these creatures are actually the offspring of the Chitauri. The way they gather substances from human beings and from animals, the way they are the forerunners of the Chitauri in any place. And if you are very close to one of these creatures and you look into its goggle-like eyes, you will see round eyes, Mr. Ick, beyond this black goggle-like stuff. And these eyes are the real creature's eyes. Now let me tell you, there is in Lesotho a very strange mountain, a mountain called Leribe, L-E-R-I-B-E. On this mountain, very amazing things happen after every 10-year or 20-year period. Now, not so long ago, an African farmer found an object near that mountain, an object which had crashed. And he was driving his tractor, and he saw this strange object lying in the ground with tiny little bolts of lightning racing all around its edge. And the African walked up to the object, and when he wanted to touch it, a strange power struck him and sent him sprawling on his back to the ground. The African got onto his tractor and got out of there. What the African had seen had been a crashed UFO, a flying saucer. He described it very amazingly. And he said that after a few days, there appeared what he said was a huge removal van, very big.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this brings us to the close of tonight's broadcast, even though we're going to finish the story Saturday night at 7 p.m. on Morris Talk Live 100. And there are other things that we are going to bring this this topic to a close. And what we are trying to do here is expose the foundation or the origin or ancient origins of the bloodline that leads all the way up to the person, the people, the organizations that we're calling the Illuminati today. And what Credo Mutua is doing is he is revealing knowledge that has been kept a secret for hundreds of thousands of years by Africans, but because of the attacks against the African people and the fact that Africa is dying, he is coming forward even at the risk of his own life and revealing secrets that have been kept for many, many years. And it is a very, very interesting story, a very powerful story, and it is one that a lot of scientists and scholars are verifying at every turn. And we want to reveal this here so that the Moors would have this. For those of you who haven't heard this before or actually seen the videos, you can go to YouTube, and the entire thing is set there for you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to have to bring this thing to a close. And don't forget, you can register with the Moorish American National Government by going to SevenSealsPublications.com. That's SevenSealsPublications.com. The registration form is there. You can go ahead and enter your information and click send. And that puts you on the tally sheet of the census, and that is what's going to be taken to the UN to declare the Moorish American National Government as a nation. Also, you can go to MoorishAmericanGov.org. MoorishAmericanGov.org. And there you can also register and examine the site and all the information that's available to you as well. To dial into the conference calls that's held 7 days a week starting at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, you dial the number 760-569-7100, and the code to dial in is 437-966-pound. And the ladies are available on Tuesday night for their conference at 218-862-1442. And the access code is 101-5555-pound. Okay? Now, we've come to a close tonight. And until Saturday night, I've been your host, Tahaka Amana Elbay. And I appreciate you listening in. And you all have a good night. I don't